Good afternoon. Happy Friday. Hope you're having a good one. Hope you're heading to the weekend in a good mood, good vibes, good plans ahead. You can't go watch the Toronto Blue Jays this weekend, but you can watch them on Sportsnet. You can listen to them on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Game two of a four-game set against the Minnesota Twins goes tonight. First pitch, 8:10 with Ben Wagner. The series couldn't have got off to a much better start. The Toronto Blue Jays, undefeated in the Whit Merrifield era. They win 9-3 last night. Pretty fun one. Fourth inning, Alek Manoah weirdly lost his control for a little bit, walked a couple guys, hit a batter to cash in a run. Otherwise, he was Alek Manoah. Two earned, two hits over six, five strikeouts. ERA goes up to 2.45. When you're giving up two over six, and that's hurting your ERA, you're in a great place. Tim Mesa, Jimmy Garcia, and new Blue Jay Anthony Bass close it out for the bullpen. Anthony Bass gives up a low leverage, nothing home run in the ninth. No big deal. Not, probably not the way he wanted to debut, but Jake Cave had other ideas. Jake Cave, by the way, some great graying in his beard. As someone who's starting to get more and more grays in mine, someone who can pull off the starting to lose the color as well as Jake Cave, I appreciate it. So not angry at him getting a home run. Also, he's way younger than me, so it makes me feel better about the grays in mine coming in around the same time. On the hitting side, much more interesting for the Blue Jays. They had a new batting order last night. We talked a lot on this show Wednesday after the game about the possibility of moving Bo Bichette even further down in the lineup. One of John Schneider's first moves when he took over was to bump Vlad to the two spot, slide Bo down to the four spot. Vlad has responded excellently, hitting the ball super well since that change. Bo Bichette had not. He'd been struggling mightily. Same approach issues that you're used to talking about with Bo Bichette, the hyper-aggression early. Last night, he slides down to the five spot. It's just one game, but he goes 3-for-5. And as our pal Chris Black pointed out on Twitter, at Down to Black, it appeared he had at least a pretty concrete approach. And that was jump all over fastballs. And that seems like an oversimplification, but when Bo's been his hottest this year, it's felt like it's when he's locking in on certain pitch types. I remember there was the Cincinnati series where he homered twice in a game off of sliders, and Hunter Green obviously throws a ton of heat. Bo Bichette hasn't always had the most luck with hard fastballs up in the zone this year. And he was sitting slider that whole game, that whole series, really. And he was just roping sliders for a little bit there. Yesterday it seemed like fastballs, they were still aggressive plate appearances. Bo Bichette at this point, he's not going to take a ton of walks. But 3-for-5, pair of doubles, a single. This is a guy who led the league in hits last year, almost hit 300, hit for a ton of power. No reason we shouldn't expect him to, and maybe he doesn't reach last year's levels. Maybe that was a high watermark, but hitting 260 with a 720 OPS, there's a lot more in Bo Bichette's bat than that, even with the approach issues that have plagued him. So that works out. A little bit of a frustrating moment early in the game where Vladimir Guerrero Jr. comes up with the bases loaded, two outs, and he grounds out. Big opportunity missed. Felt like it could be big later in the game. No matter. First of all, Teoscar Hernandez stays hot. Homer's in the sixth. But Vlad comes up again with runners on base in the eighth and hits just a monster home run. And I don't mean monster home run by distance. And I don't mean monster home run by height. That ball got out of there. 115.4 miles an hour exit velocity on that one. And I know we don't have great baselines for exit velocity in our minds yet. We don't have the scale maybe. That was the ninth hardest home run hit in all of baseball this year. And it was hit at the seventh lowest launch angle of any home run in baseball this year. We're going to talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com and Blue Jays Central later. And I'm going to ask him, when you see the leaderboard of balls hit that hard, that low off the ground, and that result in home runs, it's basically Giancarlo Stanton and Vlad. And I kind of feel like they're in a race to see who can hit the first ever ground ball home run. Because those guys just rope those low liners that, you know, you jump to catch it, probably takes your glove off by the time it's reaching the wall. So fun one there. Vlad gets a three-run shot, part of a six-run inning. Jays win 9-3. Whit Merrifield debuts, goes 2-for-5 with 3 strikeouts. The 3 strikeouts are pretty rare for him. His whole thing is bat-to-ball ability and not striking out. Really good story up at sportsnet.ca from our pal Arden Zwelling on Whit Merrifield, on any opportunity to talk about Zach Greinke is a good one, and I know Arden feels similarly when it comes to writing. Zach Greinke sending Whit Merrifield a screenshot upon the news of the trade. That's just his actual stats and his expected stats. Basically a nod of, hey man, you're better than you've played. Keep your head up. That or Zach Greinke was chirping him, and I don't, you know, with Zach Greinke, I'm not sure we can ever 100% tell, but Whit Merrifield comes in, gets 2 hits. By the way, if you missed it yesterday, he will be available when the team comes to Toronto. That status has changed, so he's not expected to miss any time. That we could put a bow on that conversation, which is nice. What we got to figure out still is, can Whit Merrifield play center field? And that's something that he talked about before the game. He was talking to Hazel May, and we talked about it yesterday on the show a little bit. We talked to Dan Zimborski, who is a Royals guy and has seen a lot of Whit Merrifield. He'd only played center field 6 times over the last couple years before last night. He looked okay out there. I mean, it wasn't the smoothest of route running or anything, but he has the speed. His metrics when he's in the corner outfield spots are really strong. There's not a good reason to think he can't play an effective center field, at least on a fill-in basis. Whit Merrifield felt similarly. This is him talking to Hazel May before the game.
Well, hopefully a little less strikeouts. I pride myself on not striking out a lot, putting the ball in play, but I got a couple of knocks, but I struck out a couple of times. But, hopefully a little bit more contact, you know, maybe get a couple bags. But as long as we keep winning, you know, I'll keep doing whatever I need to do.
You said you got to know a little bit of Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. at the All-Star game. Vladdy with that line drive, 3-run home run. What were your impressions of him as a visitor? And then what are your impressions of what you saw tonight?
He's just an all-around hitter with, I mean, just tremendous power. And it's fun to watch. He's just a complete hitter that can hit a line drive to left and it'd be a homer. And not many people have that ability. So it's incredible to see.
Finally, before I let you go, it's good to contribute. First game, get the butterflies out of the way.
Got it out of the way, yeah. Got that first hit out of the way and first fly ball out of the way. So hopefully it's smooth sailing from here.
That was Whit Merrifield post game. Sorry about that. I thought I had the pregame clip about him playing center field, but that's okay. I will just paraphrase it for you that Merrifield said before the game, center field has always been his sweet spot ever since college. Came natural to him. It's his most comfortable position. He just happens to have played a lot of second base, which is cool to hear. You know, I don't know if I would still be as good at the position that I played in high school. I'm not, or college, whatever he referenced there. But that's fine. And post game there sounds like a guy who's happy to be in a winning situation. I know that, and full disclosure, I made fun of it on this show and thought it was awful. The comments that he had made around the time he couldn't come to Toronto, not necessarily about his vaccination status, but the message it sent to the team. And obviously Royals fans were upset with that. His own general manager at the time was upset with that. But this does sound like a guy who's happy to have a fresh start, happy to be in a winning environment. You're already starting to hear good things about you know, how he's going to fit in. And same with Anthony Bass and Zach Pop. And I'm sure we'll hear the same about Mitch White. We're going to talk to Michael Duarte of NBC Los Angeles a little later in the show. Mitch White's expected to start tomorrow. So we'll get the skinny on Mitch White as a pitcher. And I know Michael Duarte really spoke highly of Mitch White, the person as well. And this is a team that likes to have likable personalities, not the most shocking roster building wrinkle there, but that's something that we're probably going to get to know. So Whit Merrifield and Anthony Bass debut, Zach Pop was activated. He wasn't used though. Zach Collins was the odd man out. We got to it just at the tail end of the show yesterday. But there were a couple options there for the Jays to clear a spot for Merrifield. And they were DFA Bradley Zimmer and risk losing him from the org depth. Option Zach Collins, and you just have to move forward with only two catchers. Maybe that means a little less comfort DHing Alejandro Kirk every day. Or Kevin Biggio, who they obviously want to keep in the mix a little bit. Merrifield may be a little redundant with Zimmer if he can play a center field. Maybe a little redundant with Biggio if he's going to play mostly second base. We'll see. There's a lot of season left. There's going to be a lot of opportunities for Merrifield to get in there. Springer DH'd last night, so nice to see him back in the lineup. In that one, he went 1-for-4 with a walk and a pair of RBI. So good night all around. Mitch White, the one guy we're still waiting on. He's expected to start Saturday. I don't believe that's been 100% confirmed. The Blue Jays still haven't updated their probable pitchers list, but everyone around the team seems to be anticipating Mitch White on Saturday, because who else would it be? The way the rest of the series lines up then is Jose Berríos against Tyler Mahle tonight, Mitch White against Dylan Bundy tomorrow, and I'm doing pregame and postgame tomorrow. I don't know if my co-host for those ones, Julia Kreutz, knows about my whole Dylan Bundy thing, but I'm sure we'll get into it. There is a light that never goes out, as the Smiths sang. And it's Dylan Bundy. But hopefully that doesn't happen Saturday and the Jays can keep it rolling. Kevin Gausman against Chris Archer on Sunday. That should be a really fun one. With the win, by the way, the Jays moved to 59-46. The Yankees are terrible now. Aaron Judge hasn't hit a home run in like 11 minutes. Jays only 10.5 back in the American League East. Realistically, that's not the race you're looking at. You're taking a look at the wild card, and the Jays remain in that top wild card spot. 2.5 games up on Seattle, 3 games up on Tampa, 5 games up on the crop of teams that are just outside the playoff picture right now. Not a bad spot to be. The Jays continue to roll, continue to play some pretty good baseball. But this is a Minnesota Twins team that fancies himself pretty good too. They were very aggressive at the trade deadline by the standards of the Minnesota Twins. We talked to Brandon Warren yesterday of Access Twins, and he was borderline shocked that they put chips in, not just for Tyler Mahle, but for a couple of bullpen arms and a reserve catcher in Sandy Leon. So this is a Twins team that isn't going to go quietly. It'll be pretty interesting to see what the crowd there is like tonight, because it is Jose Berríos' second start back in Minnesota. Obviously a longtime Twin, very well liked there. And it's Tyler Molly's debut in Minnesota. Could be the old babyface versus babyface match, dueling chance and all that. Realistically, I think Berríos gets the nice nod first time out and that's it. You might remember the last time Jose Berríos faced the Minnesota Twins. It was in Toronto, so he didn't get booed by the Minnesota fans, but I'm sure Twins fans weren't too happy. Berríos had 13 Ks in that one, one of the best starts of his career. We've got Paul Sporer coming on a little later. If you don't know Paul, he's a podcaster and writer at FanGraphs on the Rotograph side. He puts out a starting pitching guide for your fantasy leagues every year. The dude knows pitchers at a level that very few other people know pitchers, and we're going to go into these matchups with him. Berríos, Mahle, Mitch White, Dylan Bundy, Kevin Gausman, Chris Archer. We're going to see what he thinks of the Jays' rotational playoff series as well. I know we asked a couple people about it later yesterday, how they like how the Jays, Manoa, Gausman, Berríos stacks up against a theoretical Ray Castillo, Logan Gilbert for Seattle. We'll get Paul's take on that around 4 o'clock. Again, we have Michael Duarte coming on around 4:30 to give us the intel on Mitch White, the person and the player. Also want to talk to Michael Duarte. He's in NBC Los Angeles with legendary broadcaster Vin Scully passing away this week. Not only do we now see the Dodgers with the Vin patch on their jerseys, which are available for fans, by the way, which is a cool thing for the Dodgers to do, but also tonight is the first game back at Dodger Stadium since that. So I'd imagine it's going to be a pretty special night in LA. Excited to talk to Michael about that because he's someone who has written about Vin Scully when Vin first retired. He had a great radio hit the other night telling some Vin stories. So excited to talk to him about that as well. Obviously not the reason you want to be talking about Vin Scully, but someone who Vin Scully meant a lot to and has a great handle on how much Vin Scully meant to that team and that fan base and to baseball in general. I know it's a couple days ago now, but I haven't had a natural spot to talk about it. I'm fairly new on the broadcasting side, but if you are in any kind of sports media and you didn't take something from the way Vin Scully told stories and approached the games, I don't know. I had MLB Network on TV, I think as far back as like grade 12. The number of times I fell asleep with the Dodgers game on, like, I don't know if everyone has kind of the thing where they have an NL team on the side because it doesn't feel like you're, following a team that rivals your own or that if the Dodgers meet the Jays in the World Series, you're conflicted. No, it's the World Series. You'll figure it out. And not for any reason other than the Dodgers were always the late game. And this is pre the Dodgers getting really good again. Like, we're talking Matt Kemp era Dodgers here, not this 10 straight years of being in the playoffs and being one of the best teams in baseball. A lot of nights drifting off with Vin Scully on the call. It's going to be a cool night in LA. Definitely, if you can, and if you're hanging around watching the Jays game tonight, again, 8:10, first pitch for that one, flip over to that Dodgers game. I'd imagine it's going to be a special night there. So we'll talk to Michael about that. And Mitch White. Can't lose Mitch White in it. We're also going to sprinkle in your text throughout the show. You can keep them coming to 590, 590. It's been a heavy text line week, so I don't know how many I'll get to. Really appreciate the enthusiasm, how excited everyone seems to be. And yeah, a little bit of it has been, not a little bit of it, a good chunk of it this week was frustration that the deadline wasn't spicier or frustration with Bo Bichette or whatever. But can't ever let it go unappreciated. The volume of text, the enthusiasm for the show and for the team. So keep them coming to 590, 590. Kevin from Markham asks if Anthony Bass is an acquisition or reacquisition. His buddies were arguing at the bar last night and he wants to set the record straight. I think it's fine either way. I'm sorry. They did reacquire him because he was with the team before, but they also acquired him. You can use either one. It's not a case of re-sign. I feel much more strongly about re-sign. The difference between re-signing someone and signing someone to an extension, that one always bugs me. But acquisition versus reacquisition, I don't have a strong take. I'm sorry, Kevin from Markham, that I can't settle the bar debate for you. You guys got to find better stuff to argue about. There are infinite things you could argue about. I went to a concert with JD Bunkus last night from the Fan Morning Show and had a couple drinks before and after. I'll tell you, you spend some time with JD Bunkus, there are infinite things you could argue about. Even if you just want to argue about baseball and Toronto sports, you don't need to argue about the grammar around it. Kevin from Markham, you guys got to get some better topics. So you can keep your text coming in to 590, 590 throughout the show. Again, Paul Spohr coming on later to talk pitching, Michael Duarte to talk Vin Scully and Mitch White. But after our first break, we're going to talk to Mike Petriello of MLB.com. And I do want to ask him about that Vlad home run, but we've got to explore something that has been talked about only a tiny bit, and it's probably because it's a little in the weeds and it's very contrary to the eye test. Defensive metrics think the Jays are the most improved infield defense in baseball this year. Yet, a lot of those metrics don't love the season Matt Chapman's had. If you've watched a lot of Jays baseball, I think you probably like the defensive season Matt Chapman's had. If you've had the pleasure to sit down the third baseline fairly close and watch how smooth that guy is and how easy everything looks for him up close, I think you probably are pretty happy with the defensive season Matt Chapman has had. But whether you look at StatCast or FanGraphs or pick your defensive metric, and defensive metrics are noisy. It's the part of the game we still don't have the best handle on. But Matt Chapman grades out as about average this year, despite the big boost the Jays have as a team. I have some theories. Mike has some theories. We'll see if we can make some headway with it and figure out if Matt Chapman is suddenly just pedestrian at third base, or if there's something going on here where he's in fact so good at third base that everyone else is getting the credit for it. Let's take a break. When we come back on the other side, Mike Petriello of MLB.com taking a look at the Jays' improvements on infield defense. It's also, he'll be on Blue Jay Central tonight. So just, if you're here, you know what? Actually, Kevin from Markham, if you're watching the game with your buddies again tonight and you want to have a better argument or just slide something in there, Mike Petriello is going to be on Blue Jay Central later, but you're going to get the goods here first. And if your friends aren't listening, which they should be, you can slide that in there ahead of Mike's segment and take credit for being way ahead of the curve and, you know, stump your friends there or show off to them a little bit. So Mike Petriello, helping you win bar arguments next on Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Everything you need to know about the Blue Jays, Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Joined now by my pal from MLB.com. He'll be on Blue Jays Central later tonight. Mike Petriello. Mike, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Blake. I'm doing great. How's it going?
I am well. Are you a fan of the Wonder Years, that who I played you in with there?
Man, I'd like to say that I am, except I think my pop punk obsession was like 10 years before that, so I'm not sure I know them. I was more of like a 1994 East Bay kind of punk rock fan.
Yet you are a Pup fan.
This is perplexing. I'm a Pup fan because, well, I mean, first of all, they're great. And second of all, Steve is a baseball fan who's active on Twitter. How could I not be a Pup fan?
He's a dork. Yeah, so anyway, I thought you'd at least appreciate the up late watching Korean baseball line in that song. You are always up watching American baseball and, as it were, Canadian baseball. Got to ask you about, we got to start, I know we're going to talk about a lot of Jays defense stuff, but we got to start with the home run Vlad hit last night. 115.4 miles an hour, only 17 degrees of launch angle. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the leaderboards, but that is the ninth hardest hit home run all year, the seventh lowest launch angle on a home run, and of all the balls hit that hard, only one has been, like, there's only been one instance of a ball hit harder and lower, and that's a Giancarlo Stanton home run. I kind of feel like Stanton and Guerrero are racing to see who can hit the first ground ball home run.
Well, you know what's funny about all the numbers that you just said there in regards to Vlad is that I'm listening to you kind of recite all that, and I'm just sort of nodding my head like, yep, that sounds like Vlad Jr. I don't want to say it's not impressive because obviously it's very impressive, but it's almost like par for the course for him now. It's like it's just what he does. That's how he hits home runs.
It is, and they're all just, on lines all the time. And of course, Vlad always near the top in terms of average exit velocity and max exit velocity, things like that. He's 10th in average exit velocity right now. Something that we've talked about it on this show before, but it still stands out as pretty remarkable, is if you look at all the hardest hitters, in terms of average exit velocity, Vlad is 10th. You have to go all the way down to 34th on the leaderboard for someone who hits the ball at a lower average launch angle. Even Giancarlo Stanton, who is like the closest comparable, hits the ball much higher. Is there any precedent for a guy who hits like Vlad, who just, you know, it's a lot of ground balls, sure, but even the hard hit stuff is just really on a line?
There probably is, if you go back historically, but, you know, of course, we've only got this data back to 2015, so I couldn't tell you how, I don't know, Andre Dawson hit the ball necessarily. And I think there's, you know, you think about the guys who hit the ball the hardest, and guys who hit it as hard, as regularly as Vlad has done over the last couple of years. It's what, like 5 or 6 guys, right? It's Judge, it's Stanton, Gary Sanchez was doing it for a while. There's just not that many guys who do it. So when you're saying, you know, the only two guys we can think of who fit this profile are Vlad Jr. and Giancarlo Stanton, I think that's pretty good company to be in.
Yeah, it's not bad. I don't think, you know, we can nitpick sometimes at the ground ball rate and how his performance goes up and down with that. He grounds out with the bases loaded last night and then responds with that 3-run homer that's just a laser. So Vlad is his own guy, and it's pretty effective. Okay, Mike, topic of the day. You tweeted about it last night. It's something I had wanted to ask you about today anyway. But there is some real curious stuff going on in terms of the Jays' infield defense, at least by the metrics. Give us the, before we get into some theories about it, give us the kind of high level, what is so weird about this team's infield defense?
Well, I think everyone would agree, even with the eye test and the numbers back it up, the infield defense is better than it was last year, right? How much time did everybody talk about improving the defense from last year? And, you know, you look at the outs above average, which is the Statcast metric. Last year's defense was 17th best, which slightly below average, which I think makes a lot of sense. This year's defense is 3rd best. And you're like, okay, great, job done. Let's go home. We improved the defense. We traded for an elite defensive third baseman. He fixed everything. And then when you actually look into it, it's like, hold on a second. The metrics don't love Matt Chapman. They think he's been average. And you look at what's happening here, the guys who are there and have remained are playing a lot better. Like you just mentioned all the hitting stuff about Vlad. I think an underrated part of his year this year is that this is maybe the best defensively I think I've ever seen him. You know, you look at defensive runs saved has him as the best fielding first baseman in the American League. Hmm. And isn't that a wild statement considering the way you've kind of viewed his career as he's come up? He's turned into, I believe, a really good defensive first baseman. We can get into this if you want, probably 4 or 5 reasons that have nothing to do with third base why I think the Blue Jays infield is better. And then, of course, it's weird that Matt Chapman is not rated that well.
Yeah. The Vlad thing is a big one. And I think that's, you know, the Jays infield defense being better is easy to explain. Vlad has reached maybe a gold glove level at first base. We see some of that athleticism, the ability to pick a ball, you know, the ability even to keep plays alive or turn that tough 3-6-3 double play sometimes. The fact that he was a third baseman is not all that long ago, you can notice it. And then you have Matt Chapman, who, even if the metrics don't love, he is replacing a carousel of poor defensive third base play last year. So even an average Matt Chapman is an upgrade. And then you have Santiago Espinal basically becoming an everyday player. And Marcus Semien was obviously a very good defender, but Espinal is as well. So the Jays went from -2 outs above average with their infield defense last year to +16 this year. That's a number 3 infield defense in the league. Before we get into the Chapman specific, one thing you and I talked about early in the year, and I know you've talked about it on Blue Jay Central as well, is how heavily the Jays have been shifting. How related are these things, the defense being better and the Jays seeming to put an emphasis more on putting their defenders in positions to succeed?
I really like the way you just said that, putting defenders in position to succeed, because there's actually two things about that. One is the shifting, which I'll get to in a second, but also, as you kind of alluded to, Kevin Biggio is now in spots where he can perform well. He's not playing third base, which he didn't profile at. He's not playing the outfield that much. He's gone from a -5 to a +5 just by himself, right? And I think that's really a credit both to him and where he's playing. He's not really out of position, and I think that's been huge. And then you go back to the shifting, and they have toned it down, I think, a little bit. I think maybe specifically behind Kevin Gausman on the mound, because it was getting maybe a little excessive earlier in the year. But when you think about defensive positioning, I know we sort of get into like a binary, are they shifting or are they not shifting? Because it's easy to quantify and easy to explain. I mean, it's really also about positioning. Mm-hmm. Like, are you putting guys in position where, you know, even if it's two steps closer to where the ball might be, like that's huge, right? So I think they're getting better at that. I think it's not just as easy as saying, well, shift more, win more, right? Because like the Dodgers shift a lot, but the Yankees don't. You know, right. I don't think the Yankees are not a smart team. I think the Yankees are very smart. It's just a different strategy based on who they have. So I think it's a good idea that they've been a little bit more aggressive in positioning this year, for sure. But I mean, honestly, I think the number one thing just goes back to the guys are playing better. Vlad's playing better. Biggio's in a spot where he can be better. You're getting more Espinal, who's probably their most talented infielder in the first place. That all, I think, lines up to success just based on comparing this year to last year.
Okay, so now let's get into the weird part of it. All of this stuff is moving in the right direction. Guys are in better positions to succeed. The defense as a whole is grading better. And the Gold Glove third baseman that they went out and got, who by the eye test, I would say you'd have to go back to Scott Rolen for the last time I loved watching a Jays third baseman defensively like this. The metrics for the second time in 3 years are kind of like, hey, hold up. Maybe Matt Chapman isn't elite. What is going on there?
Yeah, I'm gonna not say second time in 3 years, just because like 2020 was what it was. So
sure.
Kind of toss that out into the bathwater here. Matt Chapman is rated as a -1 in outs above average right now, and I'm sure all of your listeners are like, okay, metrics are bad, they're broken. let me say a couple of things about that. First, that's the Statcast version. Defensive Run Saved, which is run by a totally different company with a totally different methodology, also has him at about exactly the same thing. So that was the first thing I saw. It's like, this is not a one system weirdness thing. It's like two independent systems are both saying the same thing. And I've been thinking about this for like 3 months, trying to figure out what's going on. And I know when people look at that and say, well, he looks great to me. He's got this great reputation. I don't trust the numbers. Maybe that's fine. But also the same metrics loved him like to the top of the world over the last couple of years. And you can't just say, well, I trust those because I like them. And I don't trust these because I don't like these. You know, the numbers are not just there to confirm what you already thought. And you don't have to believe this, but I think it's at least interesting to try to dig into, well, why? Like, we know he got traded. I mean, that's obviously a difference, but that shouldn't matter too much. Like, what's going into this? And I think that's been a really fascinating question.
Yeah, so I have a couple theories that I don't think any of them explain it all on their own, but maybe when we start to layer in these smaller things. So I want to bounce a couple off of you and get your take on them. Is that cool?
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think I have a good answer for it. So I'm hoping you guess it first.
Okay. So I'm going to start small. And the small one is, well, he's coming from Oakland where the foul ground is enormous and he could get credit for some really low percentage plays being made in deep foul ground that he just like, it's not possible within the constraints of the field now.
I would say plausible, but I don't know that that's certainly not going to make the difference from +17 to -1.
Yeah, certainly not. But maybe if it makes the difference from +17 to +15, then our gap to make up here is shorter.
Sure.
The next one is, and this goes back to kind of shifting or putting guys in position to succeed. The Jays are positioning him differently than Oakland did to take advantage of different parts of his skill set. So what I'm thinking here is maybe they're trying to, because of Matt Chapman's arm and how smooth everything is when he does get a ball, hey, the gettable balls, we want you in range because you can make every single play of those. And we're willing to punt a little bit on the tougher to get to balls to maximize, you know, your arm and your steadiness and the ones you can get to.
I think that's potentially true. I think what would happen is if you're positioned perfectly, and obviously that never happens, but you could then be turning those opportunities from hard ones to easy ones. Like, you're right. Going to get less credit for a ball hit right to you, and if you make the play, then you would for a ball you have to make a running stop for 10 feet to your left. So I think that's plausible. I also think by extension that is probably helping Bo Bichette a little bit, because Bichette is maybe playing up the middle a little bit more, which I think is a stronger side. So I think that's not something that Chapman would get credit for necessarily, that he's helping a teammate, but I think there's something to that too.
So that's where I was going next. And this is, I'm coming from a basketball perspective with this a little bit, but one of the things we see in basketball is, first of all, the more good defenders you have, kind of the easier everyone's job is. So maybe having four good infielders, there's like an exponential thing to it that's hard to grasp. But more specifically, when you have an elite one-on-one defender, you don't have to send as much help to that matchup, and that lets you stay at home on your guy a little bit more. And I look at that, and I look at the way Bichette has been deployed this year. And even, you can extend it to if Bichette's over further to the second base side, you can then have your second baseman over a little bit more. Vlad can stay at home a little bit more. It all kind of trickles down. But is Matt Chapman so effective and they trust him so much that he's now almost getting dinged for balls he can't get to or make plays on because they are asking him to cover a wider expanse, at least in terms of like who we give and take credit from with the metrics, and that's allowing Bo to play a little better, Espinal to play a little better. That's where I was going next, and I know you kind of touched on it there. Is that part of what we're seeing here?
Maybe, and it's hard to say without like actually sitting down and looking at the numbers. Yep. But I'm not actually convinced that's happening more than it did in Oakland, because okay. We talk about the Blue Jays shifting a lot more. And when you think about shifting, what do you think about? Three guys on the right side against Anthony Rizzo or Joey Gallo. But that's not always true. Like, they're shifting more against right-handed batters as well, which means he's probably got at times more often he's got three guys on the left side like than he probably did in Oakland. So I'm not entirely sure it's about being kind of on an island there, but it might be true. It's hard to answer without like digging through each play here.
He did also, there was Semien's numbers did boost when he was next to Chapman in Oakland. So maybe something there, but okay. So I obviously didn't guess the one you're kind of waiting for me to guess. So what is your leading theory on what's going on here?
I think it's about throws is what I think is happening here. So I went through and I looked at all the plays I could find where he didn't make the play, and it was regarded not as like an easy play, but a play that should be made more often than not. And as I was watching these, I kind of noticed like, hey, he's not bobbling the ball. It's not going through his legs. These are not five hole balls here. He's having trouble completing the play. And so I thought to myself, well, we can quantify that. So what I did was I went and I looked at the outs above average for the last three full seasons, right? 19, 21, and 22. And you could split it into two. How well is he doing just like getting to the ball, receiving the ball, range wise, and then separately, how well is he doing completing the play? So listen to these numbers, right? For the last three full seasons, how outs above average, just in terms of receiving the ball, right? 19, he was plus 11, and then plus 7, and then plus 5. So, considering we're only 2/3 of the way through the season, he's going to be on the same pace range wise. Now, outs above average in terms of the throws, completing the play, plus 3, and then plus 10, and minus 6 this year. So I think that's a lot of it. And I have a couple of plays. I'll show them on Blue Jay Central tonight. Obviously, nobody can see them here. But you're going to see some examples. Like, there was a Bobby Witt infield single where he just takes forever to throw the ball, and he didn't make the play.
I know exactly which one you're talking about. I can picture it. The kind of, like, double clutch, slow, what are you doing here? Bobby Witt's very fast.
There's a couple of those. There's one where Aaron Judge just like smashes the ball down the line, and Chapman does a great job to catch it. He fields it cleanly, and then he drops it on the transfer. And there's a bunch of those, and it's like those things add up, but none of those plays get marked as errors. They all get marked as singles. So if you're a fan and you're looking at fielding percentage, which you shouldn't, like, those won't show up because they're not errors. And it's not like he's making these awful throws that are go down the line, and there's a tons of footage where you're like, this guy can't play. It's a lot of stuff like that, and I don't know why. Like, I could not tell you why the throwing part, transfer from one hand to the other, why that is not quite as elite as last year. But I think this is a main part of why the metrics are dinging him here.
And it's interesting, because if that had started, say, in 20, like if we noticed that in 2021, you know, he had that hip thing between 2019 and 2021. Maybe there's something with, you know, the mechanics or just your comfort level, you know, making that turn toward first base or whatever, but we don't. We actually saw him be better in 2021. So that's a tough one to navigate. I guess my only follow-up on that would be, like, do we have anything like stabilization rates for this kind of stuff? Like are those numbers just unfortunately noisy even in 2/3 of season sample?
That's a really good question. You honestly, we're going to put these splits up on Baseball Savant at some point, which makes you the very first one to ever hear them.
Unbelievable.
It's almost premature to answer that question. I don't know that they're like predictive of the future necessarily. Okay. I do think they're doing a good job of explaining what's happened to date. You know, yeah. I want to make it clear, I'm not trying to come on your show to explain to everybody why I think Matt Chapman is a bad fielder now. Like, I definitely don't think that. It's just trying to get to the root of, why do the metrics think he's only average this year?
No, I get it. And guys, if you're listening and you want to boo Mike later, don't boo him right now. Boo him on Blue Jays Central. All right. Let's give you an opportunity here. We'll pivot off the defense. You can tune into Blue Jays Central before the game tonight for a little bit more, and you can see some of those examples that Mike is talking about. And I think, I don't know, we came up with a couple plausible, hey, here's a run here or an out here or whatever. Maybe we can piece it together. And then there's a little bit that's just noise. So let's give you an opportunity, Mike, to win the fans back. Let's take a look at what the Jays did at the trade deadline. And it didn't blow anyone away, but they add two bullpen arms. They add Mitch White. And I know, if I'm remembering right from Twitter on the day of the deadline, you like Mitch White, but you, as you dug in, the Nick Frasso side of that deal was intriguing to you.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I can't say I knew much about Frasso before the trade, but the more I start to read about him, the more he seems like, you know, exactly the kind of guy the Dodgers would target. But that's more of a future-facing thing. Nick Frasso was not going to help the Blue Jays this year, whereas Mitch White might. He actually, from what I can tell, got pretty close with Ross Stripling when they were both with the Dodgers and might serve kind of a similar role. And I think that can be pretty useful for the Blue Jays. I know he's not the fire-breathing, like, relief ace that everybody wanted. I mean, it would have been nice if they went after Raisel Iglesias. That would have made sense. But, you know, I don't know if they didn't want to take on the money or had concerns about Iglesias being able to enter Canada. I don't know. That would have been a nice fit. But they got three good pitchers, I think, guys who are going to be helpful and useful. And I think that's not an exciting deadline, but it's a valuable one. Like, you needed arms. They got pretty good arms. You know, the lineup is kind of what it is. I think it's an okay deadline. I get why nobody's like thrilled about it or excited about it, but there weren't like a ton of great relievers that moved in the first place anyway.
Okay. So the other thing the Jays did was add Whit Merrifield. And if you ever needed an endorsement for StatCast or Baseball Savant or anything like that, Arden Zwelling at Sportsnet.ca wrote last night about how, upon news of the trade, Zach Greinke sent Whit Merrifield a screenshot of his actual versus expected results. I actually do want to hear your take on if Whit Merrifield is a positive regression candidate, but is Zach Greinke on the take? Are we expecting Zach Greinke StatCast breakdowns on Royals Central once he retires? This is a big endorsement for you guys.
You know, it's been long enough now. It's been enough years that I can probably say this without betraying anyone's confidence. Like, 5 years ago, Zach Greinke just sort of showed up at our offices and came up and spent like 3 hours talking about stats and metrics. And it was like the greatest day of my entire life.
Amazing.
Yes. And it's hilarious, too. When the Twins traded for Tyler Molle, Carlos Correa was asked about him. And he's like, well, this Baseball Savant page has a lot of red on it.
Yeah. So
we got a couple of guys on board. I don't think Merrifield is a positive regression candidate because I think it's already happening.
Right.
I think over the last 6-8 weeks, whatever, I know his season line looks pretty lousy, but you know, he was brutal for the first month and a half. And then over the last 6-8 weeks, he's kind of playing like himself again, you know? So I think it's pretty clear he's maybe past peak a little bit, especially in terms of the stolen bases and the leading the American League in hits as he did a couple of years ago. But as long as what we've seen over the last couple of weeks is more real than what we saw over the first couple of weeks, which I think I'm inclined to say it is, given that he's been a pretty useful guy for 5 years now, then I think the Jays bought a better player than just like the season long back of the baseball cards would indicate.
Yeah, that has to be the hope. And John Schneider said yesterday that Merrifield's going to have the green light on the base path. So we'll see if there's a little bit more in the legs still. One last one for you before we let you go, Mike. And this is kind of more to tease stuff that I think will be coming in the future. But you guys have this new bat tracking tech and some numbers trickling out. Can you explain to me what we're looking at there? And maybe if something has stood out to you so far, when we're looking at bat speed or plate coverage or things like that, we're getting close to being able to quantify that stuff. Exciting time over there.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. It's a pilot program, really. It was just in Houston and Dodger Stadium since like mid-May. So that's the first thing to keep in mind. There's not data for all 30 parks and everybody's in those parks. Just guys who have been through those two parks since the system came online. So I don't think I have anything interesting that's Blue Jays specific about that at the moment. But it's cool. Like, it's these high frame rate cameras that can track exactly what the bat is doing. And you think about all the other stuff we can measure. Like, we know so much about how the baseball moves and spins and everything that goes into that. And we know about how guys are running on the field and what happens when you hit the ball a certain way. And we just know very little about the bat itself. And that's, you know, private labs and in other kind of games, there's been lots of, you know, wearables you can put on it. But as far as in-game real data, we've never really had that publicly before. And so the idea was, hey, let's take the data we've had from these two parks over like 2 months, a couple thousand swings, and, you know, see what comes of it. See if there's anything like even this quickly that seems like real and actionable and entertaining. And I think there was. I mean, you look at the average swing speed leaderboard that I had even a couple weeks ago. Well, number one was Julio Rodriguez. You know, like, Jazz Chisholm was on the list. Giancarlo Stanton was on the list. And at the bottom, it was all backup catchers and middle infielders, you know. So it's like, yeah, okay, that seems like there's something there. And then once you prove that there's something real to it, then you can kind of go from there and say, okay, how much does every mile an hour of a swing matter? Is it more important that you square the ball up? Because you can also track like where on the bat you're hitting it, right? So is it more important to hit it in the sweet spot? I looked at uppercut swings versus level swings, which I thought was super cool, if only because it kind of confirmed what you thought it would. And it's really just scraping the surface. So my hope is this will be in all 30 parks in the next year or two, which I should say I don't actually know for certain that's going to happen, but I'd really hopeful that it is. And then if it is, it's going to open up a whole bunch of new doors.
That's great. It's very much the 2012-2013 NBA season where only like half the teams had sport view cameras at that point, but information was starting to become available. It's like, okay, well, we have this and we're going to measure this, but only like 40% of the league's games are included in it. Looking forward to more of that on the data side, more of what it lets you do over at MLB.com and on things like Blue Jays Central. Looking forward to hearing more of our Matt Chapman conversation on Blue Jays Central tonight. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time, man.
Hey, anytime. Thanks a lot.
Mike Petrello, MLB.com, Blue Jays Central tonight, where he'll talk a little bit more about that defense. That defensive, I don't want to say anomaly, because it's entirely possible that Chapman's throwing has taken a step back or something's going on there, but I don't know. It's hard to, especially considering Matt Chapman has figured it all out on the offensive side of things, and he's back to being, you know, not MVP candidate season Matt Chapman, but a pretty good version of Matt Chapman at the plate. I don't think it's a decline thing. I do wonder if, as we get more data on this kind of stuff, as we have larger samples and we can go back past, you know, 2015 or whatever, if two-thirds of a season is still just a noisy sample for defense, which is unfortunate to hear. But again, to draw an NBA parallel, your three-point shooting percentage doesn't stabilize until like 750 three-point attempts. You got to be like Steph Curry, James Harden for your three-point percentage to stabilize in one season. And we know that for baseball too, but we also know, you know, some of the stuff we look at, like strikeout rate and walk rate and the plate discipline stuff, stabilizes earlier and we can get a better handle on what guys are doing, what's real, what's not. We'll see as the season progresses if Matt Chapman's throwing numbers come back in the right direction. Again, Mike Petriello will be on Blue Jay Central to talk about that a little bit more tonight. We're going to take a break. On the other side, we're going to switch from the field to the mound. We're going to talk to Paul Sporer of FanGraphs and Twitch, where you can see his goofy mustache as he plays MLB The Show. Paul Sporer of FanGraphs next on Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Great daily gambling advice from JD, Blake, and Ailish in the Fan Morning Show's Wake and Rake. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. We are halfway through this show, 4 hours from the Jays start tonight. They're in Minnesota, so 8:10, first pitch. Ben Wagner will have the call for you on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We just talked to Mike Petriello of MLB.com. He'll be on Blue Jays Central before the game. And hey, if you're so inclined, if you like prospect stuff, if you've heard about this Ricky Tiedemann guy and you want to get a look, at 7 o'clock tonight, he makes his Double-A debut. He spent the last little bit in the pitching lab in Dunedin. He's already gone A to high A this year. He'll make his debut at Double-A with New Hampshire. MILB TV will have that one for you. I'm going to ask our next guest about Ricky Tiedemann, because not many people know pitchers the way that Paul Spohr of Fangraphs and Twitch knows pitchers. Paul, what's up, buddy?
Blake, great to talk with you. How are you?
I am excellent. It's been a little bit since we caught up, and I'm going through your tweets and I'm trying to see, you know, what might Paul want to talk about. And I can't get past the mustache, man.
Thanks. It started as mostly a joke. I mean, I grew it out after my dad died. He had a really prominent mustache. He was blessed with some Magnum PI-esque follicles. So, you know, I just kind of have kept it going, and I like it. And honestly, you know, not to be all like, oh, my girl runs my life. But, you know, if my girlfriend absolutely hated it, like scratched her face and she was like, that's terrible, I wouldn't have it. But she's totally fine with it. So that makes it easy, too.
You're a little more flexible than me on that, because I have a beard and I haven't shaved like all the way down in forever. And I don't know if I could. I think I would look way older. I think I would look more weathered.
But if you came in with that,
yes.
See, that's the thing. If you came into the relationship with that, that's understandable. Yeah. She made a choice. I sprung this on Jen.
That's
so,
fair.
You know, she's like, okay, I guess. But no, she's had no problems with it. So that makes it easy to rock with it too. So now I embrace it. Frankly, I need to update the Twitter profile, because that's now an outdated picture, because I've been having the mustache for over a year.
I have MLB Network on in the studio right now, and there are all these old Yankees highlights on, and you forget that despite all the Yankees stuff about the way guys look, you are allowed to have a mustache.
Yes.
So
yes,
that's
you can still have a cool stash.
A weird,
so I can still play for the Yankees.
You could play for the Yankees. I could not. All right. Let's talk about a different AL East team. Let's talk about the Blue Jays. I mentioned before I brought you in there that Ricky Tiedemann will pitch for Double-A New Hampshire tonight. It'll be his first start at Double-A, rocketing through the system this year, rocketing up prospect lists. I'm curious as to your take on what the Jays have done with him and a couple other pitchers from a developmental perspective. And what they did was he went from A to high A, and then before he made that next step to Double A, he was put on the developmental list. He spent some time in Dunedin at, you know, the pitching lab or whatever you want to call it. And the idea from outside seems to be, let a guy go there, work on some stuff, check in on the development, and not run up the innings clock. As someone who follows pitchers so closely and pitching development so closely, what do you think of that as a kind of next step in how we develop pitchers?
Yeah, I actually think it's great. And I really like a lot of what the Jays are doing, both at the big league level and now throughout their minor league system, so that they can cultivate guys instead of just kind of having Pete Walker and company try to fix them when they get them, have them ready, you know, as prospects coming up. So I do like it. And I do think it's, you know, a little bit more outside the box. Teams are trying things differently. You know, we've had the pitch counts and 100 pitches being a magic number for years, and it hasn't done anything to curb injuries. Like, we don't have any good systems, and I don't think there is no perfect system. So, you know, they're chasing a holy grail that I don't think they'll ever land on, but you might as well try some different things, because the old tried and true, so to speak, is not keeping guys healthier at any sort of extended clip. So figure out better ways for development. You take your chances with the health. You know, even the guys who are deemed very durable, they're only durable till their next pitch. It's a little trite, but it's so true. Some guys have heightened injury risk, of course, because they have chronic injuries, but most guys are simply a pitch away. So try to set them up in the best situation that you can in the interim there. And I liked what they did with Tiedemann, with the A to high A, and then the time with the Lab before Double-A, which is going to make the debut tonight. He's been having a brilliant, brilliant breakout season. He's moved from 6 on our list at Fangraphs to 3 among the Jays. Some of that was graduation and the trade of Groshans, but also definitely a little green arrow next to him because Tiedemann's on the rise.
So the Jays did send out Groshans, and they add 2 relievers there in Zach Pop and Anthony Bass. The other moves they made, though, are the ones I'm really curious for your take on. And I would love to hear your thoughts on Mitch White as someone who could potentially stick at the back end of a rotation or is maybe better off in a long man role in the bullpen. He's going to start tomorrow, it sounds like. Ross Stripling's on the IL, and, you know, everyone likes to make the Stripling comp because they both...
I mean, it's easy, right?
Yeah, and for a lot of reasons.
I was going to do it, too.
For a lot of reasons. So give us the skinny on Mitch White. What are we looking for when he takes the hill tomorrow?
Yeah, I was definitely going to make the Stripling comparison there because it is so easy. And I'm a big fan of both, actually. Both these Dodger guys, I wanted them to get out of L.A. so that they could be free and clear and kind of just hopefully take the reins at starting. Now, when they got White, I knew it was going to be like they wanted a swing man more so than somebody who had to be starter. And obviously White has done bullpen stuff, so he's going to be fine kind of moving in and out as they need him. Turns out Stripling goes on the IL right away. Boom, they need White in the rotation. The key for Pete Walker and company will be if they can figure out something with his fastball, because right now it's really bad. And that's a tough way to go. It's a tough way to find consistent success if you don't have a reliable fastball. But he has enough secondary stuff, and the fastball is spotty enough, you know, in and out, that he's found some success. 3.70 ERA, 1.25 WHIP. I think that's probably in the range of where he can be. Probably more of like, you know, in the lower 4s ERA, I would say. But I think a 1.30 WHIP or lower, or a sub 1.30 WHIP will be successful enough to be a quality fill-in starter for Mitch White. If Pete Walker has some plans for him to fix the fastball, there could be more here. This was a big-time prospect. He's 27 now. Mitch White is not still a huge prospect, but there's a little bit of another level there if they can figure out the fastball, but that's definitely the key. So if you want to figure out one thing to keep an eye on, just keep an eye on that fastball. Is he hitting the spots that Jansen and Kirk are putting down for him? Is he having success with the fastball? That's going to determine how far Mitch White will go. But it was a good pickup because they needed somebody who can be a true swing man, and he can absolutely fill that role because it is a talent to be able to go bullpen to starter back and forth on a moment's notice like that.
Yeah, that's it's a good endorsement of him. And the fastball is interesting, especially when you're talking about like reliever to starter kind of switch, because one of the things I think we look for is like, okay, if a guy's going to be an effective reliever, you know, oh, focus in on a couple pitches and really let that fastball play up. And he's kind of, you know, again, the Stripling comp of, well, you don't have a reliever's arsenal. Part of the draw is that you throw all these pitches. From a next step standpoint, and maybe this is an offseason thing because they did get White to fill in right now in the short term, in the immediate term. So maybe you don't want to tinker too much with a guy on the fly. But when you look at the fastball and what needs to improve there, or just in general with his 5-pitch repertoire, do you think the move is the one we've seen the Jays do with a couple guys in the past, which is drop one or two of the pitches out of the mix?
Either shave it down.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Blake. I'm sorry.
No, just focus in on, you know, say 3 pitches, get those really where you need them, and then you can bring the other stuff back in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think either a combination of shaving down the arsenal and fewer fastballs. So figure out what they like best between the slider and the curve. Dive into that as kind of your primary, which we've seen so much across the league now with fewer and fewer fastballs. Don't use the fastball as much. Pare down the arsenal to their very best. I think they've probably got some plans in mind for him. And you never know, you know, I don't know anything about what sort of coachability he has or how quickly things will turn. But I do think that they probably have some ideas of things that could tweak Mitch White and get him pitching at the best that they can for him in Toronto. And we'll see if some things work out. I'm actually really eager to see him start here. And I thought it was a really nice pickup when they made it.
That's it's good. It's nice to hear that from an outside perspective too, because I have dug in on Mitch White and I've gotten kind of optimistic that he could maybe be something. And then, you know, you always have the momentary worry, at least, of like, Well, am I just searching for reasons to be optimistic, or is it really there? Because, you know, a gimmick that I do sometimes is you give me 2 minutes on anyone's FanGraphs or StatCast page, I can sell you on them or I can bury them completely.
Exactly. That's the beauty of stats, right?
Exactly.
You can find something.
Yeah. Jordan Groshans, get out of here. Who needs him?
Oh, man.
Give me 2 minutes with the slugging numbers. Okay. So the other guy that Jay's picked up, and I know you guys talked about him on the Rotographs podcast the other day, Whit Merrifield. Known commodity. We just talked to Mike Petriello, and yeah, some of the numbers have come back up from a hitting perspective, but the thing you guys were most interested in is that's a guy who stole 40 bases last year, mm-hmm. and manager John Schneider said yesterday he's got the green light. Do you think that that's something that Whit Merrifield is going to bring to the Jays, or kind of, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, maybe the speedy days are behind you?
No, I think it's definitely, I'm glad to hear that too, because I kind of figured that they were going to see his track record and understand that Whit Merrifield has been so sharp on the bases, his additional base running via steals, via going first to third, first to home, second to home type stuff has been part of his value in addition to being, you know, quality hitter, a good defender all over the diamond. So I was going to be really surprised if they'd even put a yellow light on him, let alone a red light. No, the Jays are not a heavy running team, but I don't think that they slow down their guys that have the capability. And I think that's the case for a lot of teams too. Even teams that are like known for not running, like the Tigers have been in recent years, they haven't had personnel that will run. So when they finally have somebody, they'll let that guy go loose. And I definitely think that's the case with Toronto. They don't really slow down their guys that are capable of running. They're kind of a lower mid-pack team. They're the 22nd most steals right now with 44, but that doesn't bother me for White. I'm not surprised to hear that they turned the green light on for him, and I believe he's earned that. And, you know, if you're looking at the bottom line numbers, Jays fans, I promise you, his first 27 games are pulling a lot of weight on the negative side for his numbers. Whit Merrifield has been himself over the last 69 games. He's had a really nice 282, 334, 425 line with six homers and 12 steals. That's a full season of 14 and 28. So he's back. He's himself. I got to knock him for having no conviction on the vax stuff. I stand by, you know, getting the vax. I think he should have just gotten it. But to not get it because the Royals were bad and to now get it because you're on a good team, I think that's lame. At least have some conviction for something. But at least he's not letting that hold up and prevent him from being part of a pennant race when he didn't really believe in it for any, or, you know, go against it for any sort of convicted reason there. So I thought that was kind of weak of him, but he will be an addition to this ball club without a doubt.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's probably something this team and Merrifield will want to put behind them pretty quickly because it is, I mean, Dayton Moore came out and was basically like, this is like, what the heck? How could you say that? That like not even imply it, just like, yeah. If I was on a better team, I'd do it. But
yeah, it's just like, and they had so many guys too. They had like 10 guys who couldn't go. So a lot of them felt that way. I wonder if that clubhouse is maybe crumbling in some fashion where they just had these,
or maybe
these
it's a little better now.
Maybe now that they're both gone, they can find some new leadership and they go a different direction there with Benintendi gone, because he too wasn't vaxxed and now he is with the Yankees. So neither of them were convicted to it for any sort of, you know, reason other than I don't want to do it and we're terrible. But now that they're on the Yankees and the Jays respectively, they did it.
I will tell you, Paul, this has been something we've had to talk about too many times this year as each team comes here for the first time. Yep. And short of it being a Twins series in the playoffs, I think we're done. Like, I think the teams that are in playoff positions are there now. Like, the Yankees and Astros were, the Jays are. I don't know. The Red Sox are falling out of the race. I don't know if we have to do it anymore, which would be really nice. Tyler Molly is the only question mark, I guess. So let's use that as a pivot point to the AL Central. I know that you're a Tigers guy. Little surprised neither of Gregory Soto or Joe Jimenez moved. I know Michael Fulmer did, but I thought for sure Jimenez would be on the move.
I thought Jimenez, Soto didn't have to be, you know, he's a two-time All-Star. Make sure you know that eyes are very much rolling. But, you know, he's got team control. They didn't really need to. Jimenez has another year next year. The problem was, I think, with when you start to get in some guys like in the Jimenez class, there were a million Jimenezes available. And at a certain point, you just ran out of slots to put them. So at least they traded Fulmer. They could have traded Chafin too. He's got a player option for next year at 6.5 mil, the same 6.5 he's making this year. So I think that would have made him more appealing to another team. But it's fine for the Tigers too if he accepts it and sticks with them. So they didn't have to. They got Grossman and Fulmer out of there. I thought Jimenez would go too, but Soto was not as pressing as far as I was concerned because they'll still have multiple deadlines to trade him. Or what I hope is that obviously that they get better so that they don't want to trade him, but I am a little bit skeptical of that, especially after the disaster that this year has been.
Yeah, and, you know, when a top prospect of, like, Spencer Torkelson's of his level kind of has the season he's had, it's a little tough as well. So let's focus on one of the other teams. And the Tigers sold a little bit. The Twins were the big team to add. And that was kind of counter to what the Twins have done in the past. It was a little surprising to see them aggressive, and at the same time, a little surprising to see Cleveland and Chicago do nothing or next to nothing. What do you make of the top of the AL Central the rest of the way here?
Yeah, I loved seeing the Twins push chips in. You know, they've got Correa for the rest of this year, and they don't really know after that. He might opt out, take another bite at the apple, and see if he gets that big 7-plus-year deal or whatever he's chasing there. I'm sure he's having a decent time in Minnesota. He's playing well, and they're doing well, but there's no guarantees of him. So you're in contention. You're leading the division. You've got Correa right now. This was the time to push, and the moves they made were really sharp. I really liked getting Tyler Mahle. I thought that was a good pickup. Jorge Lopez was a great scoop for them. They've had issues having that kind of consistent ninth. They were the ones who got the aforementioned Michael Fulmer. So I thought the moves that they did were really sharp. They're definitely the clear favorites here, even though they're only 1-2 games clear of the Guardians and White Sox. Guardians aren't too bad. They did their normal cheap ways where they didn't do anything. I thought that was actually a pretty big fail on their part. They should have done something. They're so close. I think they could have done something to, like, improve catcher, go for, like, a Wilson Contreras or maybe a Sean Murphy if they want something that's a bit further. That way they're not doing a short-term commitment if that was their big issue, was like, oh, we don't want to do a rental. So I thought the Guardians blew it. As for the White Sox, they've decimated their system enough going in over the last couple of years.
And they're cursed.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and they're just so cursed with all these injuries. Nothing's going right. It's the curse of La Russa, though. They made their bed. They can lie in it. That move was never not stupid. Sorry for the double negative, but, like, it was always such a bad move from the jump that they're reaping what they sowed with this. So I'm not shedding a tear for them. It was a dumb move. They should fire him now. But they got to go with the horses they've got. This is still a contending team. I would be 0% surprised if they won the division because the horses they have. But they need to figure out a way to stay healthy and get everybody pulling in the right direction.
So are the Jays have the Twins tonight in Game 2 of a 4-game set? We get to see Tyler Mahle tonight. He's up against Jose Berríos. Mahle is not, he's very rarely faced the Jays. Like, almost his entire sample against active Jays is Raimel Tapia. Like, Trevor Richards is third in plate appearances against Tyler Mahle, and he's
that's hilarious.
A reliever. So from a, I know a lot of what you do with pitching, you come at from a fantasy angle. When a pitcher is facing a lineup for the first time and it's the hitter's first time getting a look, is that a case where you'd give an edge or a bump to the pitcher in your projections or how you're setting up your lineups for the night? Like do we give Mahle kind of a plus sign next to him because the Jays are unfamiliar?
I have an inclination to do that sometimes, but then you think about the information age that we're in. And yeah, there's nothing like getting in the box, right? No matter what you're simulating, it's nothing like getting in the box against somebody. At the same time, it's not like, you know, Mahle's a good pitcher, but he doesn't bring 100. He doesn't have, you know, one of those 95-mile-an-hour sliders. He doesn't have anything that's, like, super unique to face. So they probably can emulate a pretty decent bit of what he's able to do, kind of figure out the game plan against him. So no, I wouldn't necessarily give too much of a jump there to Mahle facing the Jays kind of clean here, especially a Jays lineup the way it's been, you know, that it's such a good lineup. So no, I would call it kind of neutral. He's a good pitcher. The big benefit here is getting out of Cincy. He was a disaster in Cincy, whether you're talking about fantasy or just for the Reds, because he's a home run guy. So That's another reason I wouldn't necessarily favor the Jays, though, because they've got home run power, you know, throughout the lineup, and that's his biggest issue. So if they get a few long balls off of him, it could be a tough day for Molly there against that Jays lineup.
Last one before I let you go, Paul. Jose Berríos has strung together a couple of pretty good starts in a row now, six straight with three earned or fewer. Five of those six, he had six-plus Ks. Are you at a point where Jose Berríos is kind of back in the trust tree for you?
Yeah, definitely. You know, a lot of his issues have been mega bad starts, and they're very bad, mind you. Five of them really rough start, or six of them, started with that opening day one. And when it's 6 of 21 starts, that's a lot. But every single one of the other ones has been three or fewer earned runs, and that's 15 starts there. So, yes, his inconsistency is known. It's just been a little bit more wild this year with a few more duds than usual. I think he's fine. And as long as he can command the curveball, hopefully he can avoid another six earned run outing the rest of the year.
Yeah, that would be ideal, especially looking ahead where he's probably, you know, the Jays are headed for the wild card series in all likelihood, and he's probably getting one of those three starts. So six earned run one wouldn't be the best. Paul Spohr, you are the best. Thanks so much for taking the time. Keep up the great work at Fangraphs, and you know, best of luck with your OOTP and MLB The Show streaming on Twitch.
Blake, thank you so much. It's great talking with you. Hopefully we catch up down the line.
All right. Paul Spohr of Fangraphs. You can catch out some of his baseball video game stuff on his Twitter at Spohr, S-P-O-R-E-R. You can check him out on Twitch as well. And then again, Fangraphs on the Rotographs side. Lots of great work. If you're a fantasy player, Paul's a must-follow for pitching updates and a must-read for kind of keeping up with the league over on Rotographs. And then the starting pitching guide that comes out before the season, it's a nice little edge you can get for your fantasy leagues. I know not everyone plays, but I would imagine a lot of the analysis is useful for if you're doing some betting as well, or if you just want to be a smart fan and know who's out there. Maybe Mitch White would have been on your radar. Maybe you'd be in the camp where Mitch White is better than Noah Syndergaard in your head. I don't know. Who's to say? We'll see tomorrow, probably. Not head to head, but we're probably going to see Mitch White tomorrow. I think we're going to get an update on that within the next little bit here. Maybe our timing doesn't line up as well today for John Schneider comments because it's an 8-10 start, but we'll see. We're going to take a break. On the other side, we're going to get to know Mitch White a little bit better by talking to Michael Duarte of NBC Los Angeles, who covers the Dodgers regularly. The Dodgers' first game back in LA after the passing of Vin Scully. So potentially a very emotional night in LA. We'll talk to Michael about that, and we'll get to know Mitch White next on Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The smartest takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's Nipsey Hussle, and that's Trace Thompson's walk-up music. It's pretty good. I don't want to say pandering, but that's like a supercharged version of when the Jays use Drake as their walk-up song. Going with Nipsey in L.A. is a nice touch. Klay Thompson's brother. Klay Thompson, by the way, who whenever he's at the games is just the most entertaining fan imaginable to watch cheering his brother on. From down in L.A. of NBC Los Angeles, we're joined now by Michael Duarte. Michael, how are you, man?
I'm good. I heard you just guys talking about Klay and Trace Thompson. You know, I asked Trace the other day if the Lakers and Warriors met in like the Western Conference Finals, would he be out there in a Warriors jersey, cheering his brother, going crazy, chugging beers like Klay? And he said, absolutely not. He would still root for his brother, but he would not wear any memorabilia because he grew up a Lakers fan because of his dad.
That's a good loyalty there. And yeah, Michael Thompson, who we've heard, a very entertaining character in his own right. What a family. What a sports family. And Trace doing the Nipsey Hussle thing in L.A. now is very cool. Michael, I want to talk to you about Vin Scully, but I'd rather start on a higher note or a less serious note. and talk about Mitch White. So the Jays acquire Mitch White, and you tweet out that you're going to miss him, and it stings a little bit. You know, I know that, first of all, I know your work, and I know you don't say that about just anyone. What has made the Mitch White experience for you as a reporter special? What are you going to miss about Mitch White in L.A.?
Yeah, thank you. I wasn't expecting you to ask me that. But, you know, in this business, as journalists, the 2 years of the pandemic excluded, you get an opportunity to meet these guys face-to-face, build relationships with players, talk to them, see them all the time. And in a case like a guy like Mitch White, you get to see them, in my case, got to see him all the way from, you know, single A Rancho Cucamonga here, not too far from us here in Los Angeles, all the way through his rise through double A, triple A. And then he was kind of a five and dive guy here with the Dodgers, a Swiss Army knife of sorts over the last couple of years. You know, he'd come in as that fifth starter in the rotation or sixth starter sometimes and dive back down to the minor leagues, or they might bring him in and have him come out of the bullpen. So whenever I got to see him and his maturation and growth as a player, I enjoyed watching that. And then I had a personal relationship with him where he was always somebody who said hello and greeted me, and we could talk about things off the field. You will not find a harder worker as well, or a guy who wants to be as good and the best that he can be as he can with Mitch White. And he's so gracious with his time with the media. Even if he has a bad start, he's never going to, you know, dodge the media or be upset in his post-game comments. He's going to tell you like it is. And you mentioned Vin Scully. He might not be as eloquent or poetic as Vin Scully when he does his post-game talk, but he's a guy I'm definitely going to miss because, you know, I got to know him at a very, very young age, got to see him to this point. I realized he was probably one of the odd men out here on the Dodgers as the second half of the season began, but he's going to be a guy I thoroughly missed. As is another guy that I spoke to about Mitch White just yesterday, and that's Ross Stripling, a guy who I consider a very, very close personal friend who is also up there with the Toronto Blue Jays. He told me personally the Blue Jays are really going to love a guy like Mitch White, and they're really going to need him, especially with some of the injuries to the pitching staff they have right now. And him, because Ross is on the IL, as well as Julian Mayweather, a relief pitcher that was eating some innings for you guys earlier in the year, and then another former Dodger in Hyunjin Ryu, who I know is probably out for the year, they're going to be able to use a guy like Mitch White.
Yeah, what's going on with the Dodgers sending all these guys with a bad bill of goods there? All these guys end up on the IL. In seriousness, did you talk to Ross Stripling at all about some of the similarities between him and Mitch White? Like, I know the comparison is very easy to make because they're both swingmen coming over from LA, but you start to get into some of what they do well on the mound and some of what Stripling's had to improve over the years. And it's kind of easy to see Stripling being a mentor slash, you know, the blueprint for Mitch White improving from here.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys just made the comparison for me. I didn't really need to discuss that with Ross himself. But what I did tell Ross, and I'll tell you, is that Mitch White, because obviously I don't think Ross gets a chance to watch much Dodgers baseball nowadays, nor do we get to watch much Toronto baseball. When they play Anaheim, I get a chance to go up there and see Ross and catch a couple of those games. But other than that, it's really just highlights. And so, you know, if he comes in well, like in fact, one of the game in Anaheim I was there at, he came in with two outs in the ninth and the bases loaded in a very, very tight situation. And Ross Stripp got out of it. And so that was a day that I called him and was able to celebrate with him. And we talked about that situation. But, you know, what I did tell Ross yesterday was that Mitch has been primarily used as a starter. He was more of a reliever in the beginning of the season. But since I would say mid-May or so, he's been only used as a starter. And in two of those games, one against Colorado, one against the Giants here recently, he took a no-hitter into the sixth inning. And that's something that Ross and I talked about because Ross knows that well. In his major league debut against those same Giants, he took a no-hitter into the, I think, eighth or ninth inning by the time he got pulled from that no-hitter, not getting a chance to finish it. I didn't think Mitch was going to finish his had he kept going, but Dave Roberts did give him a little bit of run until he finally did give up a hit because usually his pitch count was high and the Dodgers don't like letting Mitch go through the lineup a third time. But in either of those situations, he took a no-hitter in the sixth inning, and I told Ross, you know, you'll like that because he was there and experienced that himself. As far as the other comparisons, you know, Ross's best pitch, and he'll admit that to you, is his curveball. Mitch's best pitch, in my opinion, is his slider. when that thing is moving and breaking, he can throw it with some velocity, probably on 85, 86 mile per hour. It has the most whiff rate of any of his pitches. So when that pitch is on, that's when he can do some special stuff like we saw in those two games. He took those no-hitters in the sixth inning. Otherwise, he's a four-seam guy, mid-90s velocity. He does have a curveball, but I don't think he throws it like Ross Stripling does, to be honest with you. And that's kind of a three-pitch mix that Mitch will throw at you. But like I said, and you just mentioned, he can come out of the bullpen if needed. He can be a fourth or fifth back-end starter if needed. I think that's where the Blue Jays might need him now and to eat some innings up as they make a playoff run right here.
It should be a lot of fun to see. And it's always interesting, too. You know, he was doing the up and down from the minors. He was doing the back and forth from the rotation to the bullpen. And then does a little bit of stability and a change of scenery help a guy like that, help some things click? So it'll be interesting to watch Mitch White. It's going to be, it sounds like, by the way, he's going to start tomorrow. That isn't confirmed yet, but he's with the team and they have a big old TBD for tomorrow with Stripling on the IL. So trace the line from A to B, and I think we're getting Mitch White's Jays debut tomorrow. Another must watch, I think, is going to be the Dodgers game tonight, Michael. This is the first one back in LA since the passing of legendary broadcaster Vin Scully. What are you expecting at the game tonight in terms of, what the Dodgers might do, but also the level of emotion that's going to be in that stadium?
Yeah, it's been a very difficult few days here for us who knew Vin very well. He was the soundtrack of my summers throughout my childhood, throughout my father's childhood, and even my grandfather grew up listening to him in Los Angeles with a transistor radio. So Vin Scully is the bridge that spans generations of baseball fans. And it's not just Dodgers fans. It's across the league and it's across the world as far as people that Vin's touched and that know Vin just because he's a very special human being. You probably guys don't know this, but I actually spoke to Vin, I would say about 8 or 9 days before he passed. And I don't know, maybe I was one of the last reporters or journalists to speak to him. I was reaching out to him. He lives less than a mile from me. I live in Calabasas. He lived in Hidden Hills. And there was this restaurant that we both love that is since gone. It's called Kate Manolini's. They also had a location in Beverly Hills, but it was his favorite restaurant. It was my favorite restaurant. And I would go in there and see him in his back booth all of the time and go up and say hi. So I had a little bit of a personal relationship with him. I have this 4-foot by 4-foot painting of Vin Scully in the Dodgers broadcast booth overlooking the stadium, overlooking Chavez Ravine. It hangs in my office above my desk. I look at it every day as a reminder to be a good storyteller, just as Vin was. So it has been a difficult and emotional time for me personally, I imagine for all Dodgers fans and everyone who knew him. And now you're talking about tonight, Friday night, in this pregame ceremony that starts at 6:30 p.m. Pacific, in which I don't think there's going to be a dry eye in the house, to be honest with you. I know some of the Dodgers videographers and social media people that have been working on the video tributes that are coming, the celebrities and guests that are going to be there that have also said things about Vin. So I expect this to be a very emotional day. Vin was a guy who gave a masterclass in storytelling each and every night. In my opinion, he was the Picasso of play-by-play. He could take a blank canvas, and then as soon as that first pitch was thrown, paint a picture like no other. And so I hope he gets that kind of game between the Dodgers and the new-look Padres tonight. And I hope, to use one of his famous sayings, that there's cotton candy skies forever. That's how he calls and describes sunsets here at Dodger Stadium. And we've been having a lot of them recently, so I hope we have another cotton candy sky for him tonight. And the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, we throw the word goat around a lot in today's day and age. It used to mean something else decades ago. And now we have just one name for it. But we throw it around a lot. But to me, Vin Scully was the true goat. He was the greatest of all time as far as his profession as a broadcaster and a play-by-play guy.
You'll hear no argument here. I'm sure you'll hear no argument in LA tonight. And I imagine that's going to be an emotionally charged one as you set up there. And then also, I mean, at the player level, we saw some of the guys talk about it this week and how much he meant to, especially LA area guys. Michael, I really appreciate you sharing your perspective, your relationship with Vin. I enjoyed your longer discussion about it on CBS the other night. Thanks so much for taking the time and the openness about the Vin situation. I hope tonight is a healing one for you and everyone around the Dodgers.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, we keep telling these stories about Vin. It's how his legacy lives on. And I'll say one of the same things I said on that CBS broadcast that Vin said all the time. As long as you keep smiling in your life, it will brighten somebody's day. So keep on smiling. Vin is somewhere smiling. He's going to be smiling tonight watching these tributes for him. So we go out there and smile every day, try to brighten everyone's day around us like Vin used to do. And we will keep his legacy living on.
Thanks so much, Michael. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Michael Duarte of NBC Los Angeles. That'll be a heavy one tonight in L.A. Sean Manaea against Tony Gonsolin is the matchup. And as Michael set up there, it would be a fitting tribute to have one of those beautiful L.A. sunsets and a terrific Dodgers game against a very good division rival as part of the evening and what'll now be, I'm sure, the season honoring the late Vin Scully. Michael also giving us a good primer on Mitch White, who is probably going to start tomorrow. We don't have confirmation of that yet. We also don't have a lineup because you got the 8:10 game. 8:10 first pitch with Ben Wagner on the Sportsnet Radio Network. And, of course, it's on the TV side as well. So we'll see if that lineup comes in just before the buzzer here. We got another 15 minutes with you or so. But let's look at the pitching matchup because we know that at least. Tyler Molly's on the hill. He's not someone you've seen as a Jays fan. He wasn't able to come with Cincinnati to Toronto earlier in the season. He was placed on the restricted list. But here's the scoop on him. He comes in with a 4.40 ERA. Don't let that fool you. Not only is that at least a little inflated by playing your home games in Cincinnati, he doesn't have a crazy home run per fly ball rate, but Cincinnati, the ball jumps. It gets out of there in a hurry. So he'll see some benefit from getting out of there. He also has underlying metrics in the 3.5 ERA range, and that lines up with kind of the three-year sample of who this guy's been. His strikeouts are down a little bit this year, but so are his walks. And sometimes that trade-off is good for a guy. Molly doesn't get a ton of chase stuff out of the zone, but when it comes to getting swing and miss on pitches in the zone, the two names next to him on the leaderboard, Robbie Ray and Kevin Gausman. Not at the very top of the leaderboard, but when you're in the Ray Gausman category of getting swing and misses on your stuff in the zone, you're in pretty good company there. So that's what to look for tonight. Not a lot of outside of the zone chase, but if it's in the zone, you're going to have more trouble with it than an average pitcher. Molly's going to throw a 94-mile-an-hour fastball about 50% of the time. He likes to locate it up. It has a very good swing and miss rate for a fastball and just terrible contact numbers against it. It's one of, statistically, it's been one of the more effective fastballs in baseball this year, especially in that velocity range. He'll also throw a splitter about a quarter of the time. That one comes in at 86. You can make good contact on it. Opponents have a pretty good batting average against it, but it's a tough one to hit for any power. It's a worm burner. The average launch angle is very low. The slugging percentage is very low. Tough to put a drive into the splitter there. Then he'll throw a slider to righties and a cutter to lefties. Those are okay pitches for swing and miss, but those are your best chance to do damage against Molly. Again, the Jays haven't faced him. They only have 19 plate appearances as a team against him. 10 of those are Raimel Tapia and 2 are Trevor Richards. So when a relief pitcher is one of the guys with the most experience against the opposing pitcher, not a lot to go on here. We can, though, look at pitchers who are similar to Molly. And the big thing here, again, because he throws that fastball about 50% of the time, that's the pitch we can focus on. Nick Pivetta is actually the closest comparison. You'll remember that the Jays have seen Pivetta before. Not terrible results. When you look at strictly fastballs in his velocity range, in his spin rate range, Teoscar Hernandez, George Springer, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Vladimir Guerrero Jr., all guys who have done well this year against fastballs similar to Molly's. Kevin Biggio and Matt Chapman have not. And then Bo Bichette's the most interesting one because Bo Bichette has very, very poor results against that type of fastball, but the expected outcomes are very high. So maybe some misfortune there, but more Jays than not have had a good time against Molly-like fastballs. So maybe you like the matchup there. It'll also be probably a high-energy one for Molly, making his first start in Minnesota. On the other side, Jose Berríos makes his second start back in Minnesota since getting traded to the Blue Jays. He had that monster 13 strikeout, 18 swing and miss game against Minnesota earlier in the year. That was in Toronto. He did face them once late last year in Minnesota, though. Berríos has had this up and down season. He's finally got the ERA below 5. 6 starts in a row with 3 earned runs or fewer. That's not a Jose Berríos level bar, but given his ups and downs earlier in the season, I think a sustained stretch of no blowups is encouraging. He's also had 6 or more strikeouts in 5 of those games. So maybe you're looking at a strikeout play tonight, looking at that 5.5 number. Berríos, unlike Molly, is they're almost the flip side of each other, where Berríos doesn't have elite whiff rates. He doesn't get quite the level of swing and miss, but he does get you to chase outside the zone. So a little bit of a kind of contrast to Molly there. Also, the walk rate remains very strong for Jose Berríos, even when the command isn't always there. He doesn't put a lot of base runners on for free. The big thing with Berríos is the curveball. It's now his highest usage pitch, as his kind of pitch splits have tilted in that direction over the course of the year. It's easily his best pitch for swing and miss. It's easily his best pitch for quality of contact against. So you've got that fastball and sinker that have been kind of hammered. You need to throw those. You can't just throw the curveball, but we've seen Berríos nudge further and further toward the curveball being his number one pitch by volume. And I think you're going to continue to see that. The changeup's fine, too. He'll mix that in. But the big thing to watch is the curveball, how much it's dropping. If he can do enough with the fastball to set the curveball up, or as it's been a little more often, lead with the curveball and play the fastball off of that. Berríos has seen the Twins, this Twins roster, for 96 plate appearances, 25% strikeout rate, 276 expected weighted on base average, which is the Statcast thing that looks at walk rate, strikeout rate, and quality of contact. That's a very strong number. So almost 100 plate appearances of Berríos being quite good against these Twins. Carlos Correa, Sandy Leon, Jorge Polanco all have struggled against Berríos. Luis Arraez, the one name you're looking at that's had a little more success against him, especially on the batting average side. Again, still no lineups for tonight because the game's not until 8:10. We're a little before we'll hear from John Schneider and we get the lineups and things like that. We also don't have 100% confirmation what the matchups are going to be the rest of this series. We do know that tomorrow it's Dylan Bundy for the Twins. We know it's Kevin Gausman against Chris Archer on Sunday, which is a pretty fun matchup. We are expecting to find out shortly that Mitch White will start tomorrow. I will be on Jays pregame and postgame with Julia Kreutz tomorrow. So we'll tee up Mitch White a little bit more. We'll get into exactly what to look for from him. And it's 5 pitches, so maybe they're going to simplify it, shave the pitch mix down, as Paul Spohr put it earlier. We'll see. And we'll obviously break down tonight's game on that spot tomorrow, and we'll break down tomorrow's game when we do the postgame as well. So Julia and I will be with you for that. That is a 7 o'clock start. So we'll be with you from 6 o'clock, 7:10 start. Sorry. So we'll be with you from 6 o'clock. And then again, post game, the final game of this series goes Sunday at 2:10 PM. And again, that's a Gausman day. That's a Chris Archer day. Fun weekend of baseball ahead for the Blue Jays. A couple texts in the text line to wrap up the week here. Tim and Alliston says, the physics of what Vlad does with the extreme exit velocity and the low launch angles is significant. Statistical anomaly, and he plays for the Jays. Yeah, it's a lot of fun to watch. It's a lot of, it can be frustrating at times when someone with Vlad's power is hitting a lot on the ground. But when he gets a hold of one with that nice level line drive swing, it's a marvel. I mentioned it earlier, that home run last night. Only once this year has a ball been hit harder and lower and left the park, and that was a Giancarlo Stanton. Jeremy from Toronto asks, Bo finally in the five spot last night. Think he sticks here until he turns things around? And no harm to it with Gurriel, Kirkin, Teoscar all hitting well. Yeah, I think you stick with this until you don't. And that's a pretty straightforward way to do it. Like, I could certainly see if he gets red, red hot, the urge to bump him higher up in the lineup. But I think you just ride with this. And if he gets hot, you embrace that. And unless a Kirk or a Teoscar Hernandez in the 3-4 slot start to struggle, you don't really need to tweak that. I've always thought Bo Bichette's approach was a little more fitting of a power alley spot in the lineup rather than a table setter spot, just because of the approach and the aggressiveness. And, you know, if there's something that he's going to have a limitation with, it's probably the on base. I like him here. Justin in Toronto wants Lourdes Gurriel to lead off. That's not going to happen when George Springer is playing. I don't mind sliding him in there when George Springer's not playing, but you got to be realistic about what the team is and what George Springer means to him. Even if there's a sustained stretch with where Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is hitting better, I'd be surprised if you see George Springer hit anywhere but first in this lineup. Mark in Uxbridge just wants to show a little love to Santiago Espinal. We had that conversation with Mike Petriello earlier about the Jays' improvements as an infield defense. And yeah, Espinal playing a lot more is a big part of that. He's been excellent defensively. I think probably he's going to see a few less games as we move forward, as they look to get Whit Merrifield in the mix. And, you know, we have to call it as it is. Santiago Espinal, the hitting has declined a little bit. Maybe it's just a blip, but he hasn't hit the ball super well the last little while. So that's something to keep an eye on. Whit Merrifield, they're going to try to keep him involved, whether that's in center field, second base, a corner spot, whatever. He's asking about Mitch White. Matt from Toronto asks, what if, when Ross Stripling comes back, instead of moving him or Mitch White to the bullpen, they just pitch on the same day? So what Matt is talking about here is a piggyback. And that's not entirely uncommon. You saw it a little earlier in the year, basically where on a Stripling day early on, you'd pencil in Trent Thornton to follow. Or when Hyunjin Ryu was still around, that was a Ross Stripling day. It's a little tough because that basically means you're running your bullpen short the rest of the time because you don't want to do that. I think we're actually going to see Seattle do that in the next little bit. They're going to do that with potentially with Marco Gonzalez, perhaps with Chris Flexen and George Kirby. That's an interesting approach. I think you could see it. I think you could try it. I think you could also look at a six-man rotation for the busier stretches, get Alek Manoah the odd extra day off. I think the piggyback thing is something you're definitely going to be looking at in the playoffs. If you make it to a seven-game series, I don't know that there's a name on this team that you're going to trust as a true number four to go three times through an order or five, six innings. I think it would be a case where it's a Kikuchi slash Stripling slash Mitch White situation. So it's a good question, Matt. It's an interesting one. We'll see how the Jays play it the rest of the way. We're just about done here. Hope you've had a nice week. Hope you have a nice weekend ahead. Sho Ali has Jays Talk for you postgame. Ben Wagner has the call for you, 8:10 first pitch on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I will be back at 6 o'clock tomorrow to set up tomorrow night's game with Julia Kreutz. Thank you to JR and Derek behind the glass. Thank you to Paul Sporer, to Mike Petriello, to Michael Duarte for coming on today. Fan Drive Time has you next. And then Sho Ali will actually have you pregame as well with the 8:10 start. You get an hour of show before and then Jays Talk with Sho after. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. I'll talk to you tomorrow.